You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
My name is Matt Rojanski. I'm the Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program here at the Carnegie Endowment. This is obviously a relatively unusual program for us, but I think it's sort of perfect. It's well-timed, and it also is emblematic of what we aspire to do in linking many of our regional centers and our programs here in Washington that deal with different regions. So I'm especially pleased to be hosting this with colleagues from the Middle East program and to take this opportunity to look at an angle of what's been in the news almost nonstop for the last year, and that is the Arab Spring and tension over Iran's nuclear program that often gets either relatively superficial coverage or sort of secondary coverage. And so I think we can delve a little bit deeper into that. And that, of course, is Russia's role in all of this, Russia's interests, Russia's strategy, if it could be said to have one. There's a saying about allegiances in the Middle East that shift with the sands. That might be true, and you could certainly say that that is true of Russia and its relationships. And yet, on the other hand, we see evidence to the contrary, one example of which that I've been contemplating recently is the Assad family and its longstanding relationship with the Kremlin, which seems to be quite as firm as the walls of that ancient edifice itself. And so I hope that some of our panelists can address this question of whether there's been consistency in Russia's policies, at least as long as it's been Russia, and perhaps even before 1991 as well. And then, of course, the emerging dynamic of Iran's of Russia's role in the negotiations on again, off again with Tehran over the nuclear program we're going to try and address as well. So we have a very broad agenda for today. Let me just remind folks, turn off your cell phones. We are on the record. We'll try and keep it relatively tight with the panel so that we have plenty of time for discussion. Let me just very quickly run through our panelists. I think we have just a fantastic and very distinguished panel today. Marwan Muasher, former foreign minister and deputy prime minister of Jordan. He's vice president for studies here at the Carnegie Endowment and really one of the experts on diplomacy with this part of the world. Then we'll go to Natasha Moskovaya, who you can tell by her name, correspondent for Haaretz, but probably also knows something about Russia, and she is going to showcase that for us today. Also, having been a former television anchor, I think you can probably help me manage this large and distinguished panel. Then we'll go to my colleague on my left, Karim Sajidpour, who's an associate here working on Iran, and you sort of can't not know Karim if you've ever turned on CNN or PBS or the BBC. And then finally, our visiting colleague from Moscow, from the Carnegie Moscow Center, Alexei Malashenko, who's truly one of Russia's leading experts on Islam, religion and society, in particular, of course, on the North Caucasus, Russia's internal abroad, as we call it. So with that, let me turn over the floor to Marwan.
Thank you very much, Matt. The title of this seminar workshop is Russia's strategy in the Middle East. And to me, that suggests two things. One, that there is one strategy for the Middle East, and that two, that other countries also have other strategies in the Middle East. And I just want to question both to say that what is happening in the Middle East today is really too fast for any country to have come up with a coherent strategy of how to deal with it. I think the romantic notion that existed in certainly in this town, which led to calling the Arab uprisings the Arab Spring last year, is probably over by now, and people are starting to realize that this is not a process that is going to be measured in months or even years, but in decades. And I maintain that those who want to measure it by months and years will get a lot of heartburns. If one wants to look at it, take a wider view and look at it in the wider sense, then I think we can all be more realistic about a transition process that was bound to happen, should have happened. A lot of people asked why it did not happen before, but a process nevertheless that is going to go through many bumpy roads before it stabilizes and results in pluralistic societies. Now, having said so, Russia's influence in particular in the Middle East has been waning, in my view, way before the Arab uprisings. I mean, if you go back to 1972 and Russia's sort of expulsion from Egypt, that was the first maybe time in the contemporary Middle East where Russia's influence in the region, Soviet Union, then, of course, started to wane. But the second one has certainly, the second period is the Cold War. And the end of the Cold War has been particularly bad for Russia in terms of its relationships in the Middle East. It has coincided with the start of the Middle East peace process in Madrid. As we all remember, I mean, Gorbachev's participation in the process was more performa than anything else. And Russia has never played an important role in the Middle East as far as the peace process is concerned, other than to serve on the quartet, but in a very subsidiary manner and in a manner that was largely differential to that of the Americans. But the Arab uprising sort of, in my view, is putting the nail in the coffin as far as Russia's influence in the Middle East is concerned. Russia has always been seen by the people of the Middle East, largely, of course, because of the peace process and the Palestinians, as siding on, side of the oppressed in the region and as standing up to America and making sure that American interests are not advanced in an unquestionable way. Well, with what is happening in the region, first in Libya and then in Syria, it is becoming clear to at least the people of the Middle East that Russia is not necessarily siding standing on the side of the oppressed, but rather on the side of its own interests, economic interests particularly. That does not mean that others, like the United States, also don't have interests in mind. But it does mean that Russia, for a long time in the region, has been viewed as taking positions of principle when it came to Arab interests. That era is over. There is a feeling today Russia is betting on the wrong horse. Point I want to make. I don't think Russia seems to have developed any post-Cold War strategy in the Middle East. Beyond the military interests, beyond sometimes the economic interests, we have not seen really a sustained presence or influence, Russian influence in the region. Whether the Russians feel that the Middle East is of lesser importance to them or not is, another question that we might ask. Maybe Natasha can shed some light on this. Certainly, the Russians have attempted to forge relations with Israel in recent times, and I'm sure Natasha will talk about this as well. With the Syrians, Russia has a naval base in Tartus. This is the only sort of warm water base in the region. But if they are afraid they will lose that base, I think it's a very sort of short-term calculation. I think most, if not all, analysts agree that the Syrian regime will fall and that Russia would have to recalculate its relationships with Syria if they want to maintain some long-term influence. So far, the influence both in Libya and Syria has been limited to the Security Council, Russia's ability to block, if you will, a resolution on Syria. That's how it is seen, both Russia and China, and that is, frankly, as I said, contributing to the alienation of the public in the Middle East from Russia. If you look at all the polls in the last few weeks, they will suggest that the popularity of the Assad regime has dropped not just domestically inside Syria, but throughout the region from a high 3 years ago when Bashar al-Assad was considered one of the most popular leaders in the Arab world to almost zero today. There is no popularity for the regime. There is no legitimacy left domestically as well as regionally. And by betting on the Syrian regime so far, Russia is really hurting its own chances for any longer-term influence in the region. Let me stop here.
Thank you, Marwan. I think you queued up at least half a dozen questions in my mind. Natasha, I saw you writing, so I suspect you have them as well. The floor is yours.
A couple of months ago, I was asked, you know, following the Arab Spring, when the Russian Revolution will come. So I answered then that, you know, probably for people who just recently experienced one revolution, it will take some time to prepare for another one, because they know that what comes then is usually chaos and crisis, and then in terms of the government, more of the same. But then, you know, we had the parliamentary elections in Russia, and protests swept through the country. And Israel found itself suddenly on a spot that it didn't necessarily look for in this context when Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman visited Moscow and meeting with Vladimir Putin, the Prime Minister, said that based on the observations of four Israeli observers in the elections were fair and democratic. So later he, you know, tried to modify his remarks a little bit and said that, you know, in every elections we have some kind of violations, and in Israeli media there were publications that actually it was a kind of condition for Lieberman to say that in order to meet with Vladimir Putin. But anyway, this is a point, you know, to just to exemplify that in the recent past, it was Israel often finds itself on the same page with Russia, not necessarily for the same reasons. For example, both countries are quite suspicious of the Arab Spring. Russia, because it doesn't want to lose its positions on the Middle East that are waning, as it was said earlier, and Israel, of course, is wary of the rise of the Islamists, and you know, because of the security reasons on that part. I think in the past 3 years, the tensions between Washington and Jerusalem were somewhat beneficial to Russia, because in Israel we hear more and more voices talking about, you know, questioning whether it's smart to keep the exclusive relations with Washington, or should Israel develop and strengthen other partnerships. For example, they were eyeing Latin America and so on, not only Russia. I think that, you know, it's kind of long shot, but if you try hard enough, you can find even some parallels in relative isolation of two countries. Russia is not terribly popular for its gas wars, for example, or following its war with Georgia. And it was interesting to see that when Russia planned its big celebrations of, you know, 65th anniversary of World War II victory, the leaders of the allies, you know, America, Britain, France, they didn't come. And Israeli president did come and praised Russia in length, you know, for its role in defeating Nazism. So, you know, putting it a bit in historical context, it's always has been a very complicated and, you know, somewhat contradictory relationship, because, let's say, in 1947, the Soviet Union supported the partition plan. It was among the first countries to recognize Israel. Israel fought its first war with Soviet weapons. But then, of course, relations deteriorated quickly. 1953, we had the first time the diplomatic relations severed. Later that year, they were restored after Stalin's death. But then, you know, in 1967, the relations were severed for almost 25 years. Having said that, I think that since 1991, after the relations were restored, they started improving with many, many reservations and deep gaps on several important topics. We'll get to it shortly. But, you know, there are many political, economic, scientific, diplomatic reasons for this relationship to improve. And I think there was, you know, many agreements were signed. There was the cooperation, economic cooperation is getting closer. Also, I think Russia just a couple of months ago announced it will open branch of Skolkovo. It's the Russian Silicon Valley in Israel, for example. It already bought some Israeli spy drones. So there is a cooperation going on, and it's growing. And you know, look, since Russia made very clear, not only in the Middle East, but in its foreign policy in general, that it won't build, you know, an empire based on values and ideology anymore, but it will pursue its interests, Israel shouldn't expect of Russia speeches, U.S.-style speeches of common values and unbreakable bonds and so on. Having said that, if we look at some points, like, for example, the cancellation of a visa regime. It's quite unprecedented, actually, for Russia, because they didn't have the same success with Europe. But with Israel, despite the warnings of Israeli police that, you know, that Russians will flood Israel with criminal elements and mafia and so on, the visa regime was cancelled. And in 2010, I think there were more Russian tourists in Israel than from any other country. I think it was about 500,000 or 560,000 Russian tourists. So, you know, it is strengthening. Now we have four ministers in the Israeli government that were born in the former Soviet Union. Then it was the Soviet Union, of course. All of them dealing directly or indirectly with foreign relations of the country. Of course, it has an influence on the foreign relations of Israel, among others, other things with Russia. There was this WikiLeaks published cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow talking about the way Avigdor Lieberman, the Israeli foreign minister, was received in Moscow. He was defined as, you know, they received him as one of their own. Look, I think it's the credibility that Lieberman enjoys in Moscow is slightly overestimated, although it helps that he speaks Russian and knows the culture. He doesn't have a monopoly, I think, over the relations with Moscow. And I think that there was an incident, maybe you remember that, when the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, visit to Israel was cancelled because of the strike at the Israeli foreign ministry, the ministry of Avigdor Lieberman. It was an embarrassment for Israel, you know, when Russian president came to visit Jordan and Ramallah and didn't come to Israel. For me, it's important to mention also that there was misperception, I think, in both countries, mutual misperception. For example, in Israel for many years, although it wasn't an official position, of course, Russia was perceived to be as a very troubled spot, almost as a third world country despite its nuclear might. But, you know, many immigrants were coming to Israel not because of their willingness to come to Zion, but because of the pushing factors of poverty, lack of perspectives, constant crisis, and so on. Of course, in Russia, Israel was perceived for many years as a small and a country that causes lots of troubles. I think it is changing. Of course, you know, we can mention some symbolic gestures in the recent years between the countries. For example, Russia sending aid when there were wildfires in Israel, and Israel returning to Russia after almost 20 years of talks. Very symbolical, major real estate in Jerusalem, the Sergeyev courtyard, that even John McCain, I think, protested it and said, you know, it's not time for such gifts. It was the decision was made in 2008, and I think they handed the keys only last year. But having, you know, said that, all with all these positive things and countries coming closer, of course, we have several points of you know, of contention between two countries. The first one, of course, I think now is Syria, because Israel, of course, hopes for the demise of the current regime, because Israel sees an opportunity to, you know, to put an end to this marriage between Tehran, Damascus, and Hezbollah. It hopes to weaken Hezbollah this way, not knowing, of course, what will come next. But anyway, and Russia, of course, holds you know, to its alliance with Syria, and it raises eyebrows, I think, among many Arab diplomats, saying that Russia just lost touch with, you know, with the reality in the Middle East. So the second point, of course, is the arms sales, because each time there is a major arms sales deal, Israeli leaders, you can see them rushing or to Moscow or calling the Russian leaders, trying to prevent this deal. Russia, of course, then saying that, you know, it's defensive weapons, it's with tight supervision and so on, it will never reach Hezbollah, and, et cetera, et cetera. But, for example, summer 2006, the second Lebanese war, the Israeli prime minister is calling Russian leaders, saying that, you know, we found Russian weapons at Hezbollah during one of the raids, and then Putin says, well, prove it, and then the Israelis are sending delegation to Moscow with proof, and then Russia still denies it. So it's a complicated relationship, as I said, and well, with Iran, I think we will hear about it more later. I think the tensions between Russia and Israel on Iran were slightly mitigated after we all discovered that the most problematic spot wasn't the Bushehr nuclear facility, the Bushehr reactor that Russia helped to build, but the secret Natanz nuclear facility. But anyway, I mean, Russians are adamant, you know, against a preventive military strike or even strengthening sanctions, which is, of course, you know, anathema to the Israeli position. And the last point, peace process. Well, it's not really an official position, but I think Israel is not super interested in active Russia role in the Middle East peace process, because if it's less pro-Israeli, of course, than Washington, if it can be called pro-Israeli at all. And, you know, Israel is very unhappy that Russia not only not included Hamas and Hezbollah in the list of the terrorist organizations, but also, you know, two Hamas delegations with Khaled Mashal visited Moscow. And I think last year it was the first official Hezbollah delegation. And then when the Russian president went to Damascus, he met with Mashal once again. So it's, you know, it's something that Israel protests. But just to sum up, I think Russia and Israel in the past 20 years found ways with crisis here and there to circumvent those topics and to cooperate on many other issues.
Okay. Natasha, thank you very much. Karim.
Thank you all for coming. Thanks, Matt, for inviting me. Marwan used the word popular alienation to describe Arab sentiments vis-a-vis Russia, and I'm afraid that's going to be a common theme in my presentation as well, about popular Iranian alienation vis-a-vis Russia. There's a quote from Henry Kissinger which comes to mind when I think about Iranian-Russian relations. Kissinger was talking about U.S.-Iran relations, and he said, quote, "There are few nations in the world with whom the United States has more common interests and less reason to quarrel than Iran." And when I apply that quote to Iran-Russia, I would turn it on its head and say there are few nations in the world with whom Iran has less common interests and more reason to quarrel than Russia. But the relationship that you see right now, the strategic cooperation between Iran and Russia and the strategic enmity between Iran and the United States, I would argue, is an historic anomaly, which I would argue is going to be unsustainable in the coming years. And I'm going to touch on four points, the historic context of Russian-Iranian relations. Briefly, Matt gave me a look. I'll be brief in talking about the historic context, and then talk about how the Islamic Republic of Iran sees Russia, how the Iranian population sees Russia, and then if I could step on Alexei's toes very briefly and talk about how Russia sees Iran, or an Iranian perspective on how Russia sees Iran, or an Iranian-American perspective on how Russia sees Iran. But if you know, historic context, there's a tremendous amount of historic baggage between Russia and Iran. I would start in 1828, the Treaty of Turkmenchay, in which Iran abdicated a huge part of its territory. We're talking about modern-day Azerbaijan, modern-day Armenia, parts of modern-day Turkmenistan. And if you think 1828 is too long ago in the Iranian historic memory, you should remember that Iranian Shiites on almost a weekly basis celebrate various indignities which they were subjected to by Sunnis in the 7th century. So 1828 is not that long ago from the Iranian perspective. More recently, in the 20th century, in 1946, the Soviet Union tried to annex a big chunk of Iranian territory, Iranian Azerbaijan. And interestingly enough, it's something which I think is oftentimes fallen through the cracks of history books, but it was the United States under President Harry Truman which intervened and came to the defense of Iran's territorial integrity. So we hear so much about Iran's or America's role in the 1953 coup against Mossadegh, but we hear very little about America's role in restoring Iran's territorial integrity vis-a-vis Russia. More recently, in 1979, some of you know, when Ahmadinejad was elected in 2005, there were several hostages that were taken at the U.S. Embassy in 1979 who alleged that Ahmadinejad had been one of their captors. He had jumped over the walls of the U.S. Embassy and was one of their captors. And it was later revealed that Ahmadinejad at that time, I think he was probably a 22-year-old student in 1979, he had actually advocated taking over the Soviet embassy in Tehran and taking Soviet diplomats hostage. So you see that that historic antipathy is shared by folks like Ahmadinejad, kind of the more religious types and more secular types as well. So there's a great deal of historic baggage between the two sides. Now, how does the Islamic Republic of Iran see Russia, and what is the basis for this strategic cooperation between Iran and Russia? And there is a tremendous amount of strategic cooperation, at least from the vantage point of Iran's leadership. And there's a great quote which I found from the current foreign minister, Salehi, and he was talking to Russia has an Arabic television station, apparently, which I wasn't aware of, or an Arabic media outlet. So Salehi was giving this interview to a Russian Arabic media outlet, and I'll read it for you because I think it pretty much sums up the way that Iran perceives its relationship with Russia and the way that Iran, in a way, markets itself to Russia's leadership in terms of Iran's utility for Russia. So he says, quote, "The United States is trying to expand its global hegemony. Therefore, it must restrict or defeat its sole military rival, Russia. This is why NATO is expanding towards Russia and desires to encircle Russia. In this context, Iran is the sole remaining impediment to this encirclement." He goes on to say that the West tries to gain hegemony over Iran in order to complete the encirclement of Russia. What would happen if Iran returns to the Western sphere of influence? Russia would be encircled by NATO. This is why I'm saying that Iran has a vital dimension for Russia, and the reverse is also true. In my opinion, Iran and Russia need each other. Of course, Russia is concerned that Iran returns to the bosom of the West, but we tell the Russians that this will not happen. I'm very optimistic about the future of Iran-Russia relations. And I'm going to talk a little bit more at the end about this concern that the Iranians play on, that perceived concern that the Russians have, which the Iranians play on, that Russia is worried that Iran goes back to the Western sphere of influence, to the American sphere of influence. And so on one hand, Iran kind of plays to Russia's fears, and Iran markets itself as having this anti-American alliance with Russia and with China. And there's virtually, there's very little economic cooperation between Iran and Russia. China, Russia, and Iran are oftentimes mentioned in the same category, but in reality, China and Russia have very different strategic interests vis-a-vis Iran. China needs energy. Iran has energy. That's, in simplistic ways, the basis of the relationship. But for Iran and Russia, in addition to kind of this notion of being mutual adversaries or competitors with the United States, from Iran's vantage point, there's important military, nuclear, and intelligence cooperation. A former senior Iranian official told me that aside from Syria, there's perhaps no country in the world with which Iran has better intelligence cooperation than Russia. All that said, there still is quite a lot of mistrust and discontent vis-a-vis Russia, even at the official level in Iran. Quite frequently in Iranian newspapers, you read about criticism of Russia's quote-unquote delay tactics in completing the Bushehr reactor. Iran actually filed a lawsuit against Russia, arbitration lawsuit, for failing to deliver this S-300 missile system. So even at an official level, despite this cooperation, despite the fact that Iran in many ways feels like it needs Russia to compete against the United States, this historic baggage and this mistrust and discontent very much remains. Let me shift now to talking about how Russia is perceived in Iran on a popular level. And to be honest, I think there are few nations in the world that are less popular in Iran in terms of, you know, how the body politic feels about Russia. There was tremendous influence, tremendous Russian soft power, and tremendous Russian influence in Iran before the 1979 revolution, because Iran had a very strong communist party called the Tudeh Party. And the Tudeh Party, in some ways, were seen as a wholly owned subsidiary of the Soviet Union. So in many ways, Russia did wield a lot of influence before the revolution. But I recall something someone once said to me in Tehran, which I think is felt by many Iranians. He said, well, the United States and Britain also had imperial ambitions in Iran, but they also gave back something to Iranians. And Russia just took. They had imperial ambitions, and they just took, but they didn't give anything back. And if you ask people kind of what do you associate now with Russia on a soft power level, I think they will tell you these Tupolev airplanes that keep falling out of the sky. And I think they will tell you that there's a sentiment widespread among many Iranians, especially the younger generation, and I would imagine it's the same sentiment held among young Syrians, that it's Russia which is helping to keep this regime in power. Somehow Russia benefits from keeping the Islamic Republic in power. And in the 2009 uprisings in Tehran, in the aftermath of the contested elections, one of the slogans you heard on the streets was at Friday prayers. And the Friday prayer leader was trying to encourage people to shout, "Death to America, death to Israel," which is this kind of weekly chant of the Friday prayers the last three decades in Iran. And the crowds responded with "death to China, death to Russia." And you can find this on YouTube. There was kind of thundering slogans of "death to China, death to Russia." So I would say on a popular level that alienation, which is felt in many parts of the Arab world, particularly Syria, is very much felt in Iran. Let me close on the last section, which, again, I apologize for stepping on Alexei's toes here, but it's a perspective of how Russia sees Iran, or, again, an Iranian-American's perspective of how Russia sees Iran. And I think it's somewhat simple in that there's a perception that for Russia, Iran is a useful thorn in the side of the United States. This conflict between the United States and Iran and Iran's self-inflicted isolation is expedient for Russia in that it inhibits Iran, the second, which has the second largest reserves of natural gas after Russia, from competing in European gas markets. Iran has not been able to exploit its gas resources. It inhibits Iran from being able to wield influence in Central Asia, especially in countries which have been under Iran's historic sphere of influence, like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan. Iran has done a woeful job wielding influence there. That's beneficial to Russia. Iran doesn't speak out about the Chechen issue. You know, they speak nonstop about the suffering of the Palestinians. They don't raise a peep about the Chechen issue for fear of alienating the Russians. And what I find interesting in all of this, and this will conclude, Matt, is that in a way, when we talk about, again, going back to this issue of Chinese interests and Russian interests vis-a-vis Iran, I don't think that Chinese officials necessarily go to bed at night worrying about a nuclear-armed Iran. That's probably not high on their list of priorities. But by all accounts, this is a concern for Russian officials, for Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. And yet, it still seems that what's more of a concern for Russian officials is competing with the United States rather than averting the prospect of nuclear-armed Iran. So let me leave it there. Thank you.
Okay, Karim, thank you very much. A tour de force. Alexei,
Yeah. Bring
us home.
Thank you very much. And even double, I think, because practically everything about Russia's politics in Middle East was said. So I have to agree. I have to generalize a little bit, and I have to add something. So how Russia does perceive itself vis-a-vis Muslim world? It's the first question. And vis-a-vis, of course, Middle East. It seems that Russia has no adequate a picture. But since the beginning of 2000s, since Putin came to power, indeed, in Kremlin, in Moscow, began to think about how to work in Middle East and in Muslim world in general. Would it be Iran, Afghanistan, well, and so on. So 2004, 5, 6, Putin made several trips to Arab countries, to Muslim countries, and he attempted to understand what Russia is able to do. And how could relations between Arab countries, Muslim countries, and Moscow and Russia could be a construct? When he came back to Moscow, he didn't bring something new. I thought at that time that he understood, that he didn't understand how Russia is able to work. He signed several contracts in Libya, in Saudi Arabia, in Algeria, he signed the contract with Egypt, but it led to nothing, practically. So I think that was the first step of Russian government, of post-Soviet Russian government, because Soviet Union had very strong position there, to understand what could be done. What is the ideology of some Russian-Arab-Muslim relationship? I think it's very important because since Putin came to power in these years, there was an idea that Russia must or is able to occupy a special niche, special political some niche, a little bit closer to Muslims, to Muslimhood. Because of Eurasianism, because of multi-confessional some character of Russian society, Russia maybe could... is able to perform a role of bridge. It's a stupidity, in my opinion, but anyway, it was declared. What does mean a bridge? It means the possibility of becoming mediator. If you ask me, mediator between whom and whom, I don't know. But practically, it was a semi-official declaration. Russia is able to mediate between West and the rest, between Iran and the West, between Libya and other countries, and so on. And indeed, Indeed, Moscow, foreign ministry, presidential administration, they attempt to do something. If you followed that time, the events, as far as the relations between Arab world and Muslim world and Russia is concerned, indeed, there was a number of delegations in Moscow, outside Moscow, and so on. It led to nothing. Russia practically failed as far as its position of a mediator is concerned in the situation around Iran, failed also in Middle East in the conflict between Israel and Palestinians. Then was the case of Libya, when indeed maybe that could be the only one chance. When Mikhail Margalev attempted to talk to Gaddafi and he did his best, but he failed. At the moment, we observe how it's going with Syria. I think that you agree with me is if I say that it will lead to nothing. Of course, Russia is able to show some of its activity. Of course, Russian newspapers and electronic mass media are full with some information of Russian activity. But in fact, even in Moscow itself, they understand very well that Russia is important. They can talk, they can describe, they can make some declaration, but everybody knows that regime of Bashar al-Assad will disappear. Even if Russia dares to send several ships, well, it means nothing. More, if we look at what Russia is doing, practically Russia prefers to deal with charismatic, authoritarian dictatorship. Well, you can call it a post-Soviet tradition or Soviet tradition. Okay, I agree. But look at the map. The regimes who are closer to Russia, indeed, before they had fine relations with Moscow, even in the time of Brezhnev. And now there is a heritage. There is the line of such kind of friendship continues. To what extent it will lead? Let's see. Just I don't want to talk a lot about Russian material interest. If somebody is able to tell me how many wells, Russia kept in Middle East, in Libya, in Iraq, I don't know, and nobody knows. I think that the number of these wells is minimal. About armed trays, some deaths you know about planes, about aircrafts, and so on. But this is a very old material. And everybody, including in Kazakhstan, in Tajikistan, dreams how to replace it. And if I were Putin or Medvedev, I would think more not about trade with Syria, Libya, and so on, but what to do with China and India. Because from that point of view, Moscow is losing its position in these two countries, key countries for Russian military production. Before I spoke about Russian dreams, about Russian ideology, about so-called Russian interest, and so on. But at the moment, what Russia is able to do? What I am able to do as a president of Putin since March? Is Russia able to protect Iran? No. Is Russia able to keep some regime of Assad? No. If Russia is able to make Bashar to evaluate, to be more normal? No. I remember the time of the Soviet Union in 70s and 80s. At that time, I lived in Egypt, in Libya, in Algeria. These countries, these lands, were full of shuravi, of Soviets, full. And of course, these countries was full of some Russian military assistance. Yeah. At the moment, what we have? Nothing. It disappears. Russia is losing its alliances. Some like Gaddafi, like Bashar, and so on. Who will come instead? Nobody knows. But I'm sure that some Russia is unable to recalculate, it's not my expression, recalculate its ties, its links, its position with those who will come. What do you think? If somebody in Moscow is able to talk to Muslim brothers, in the time when Primakov was foreign minister, I think it was possible. At the moment, I don't know. Maybe, perhaps, but I'm not sure. So some Russia, well, isn't ready to deal with a new political and religious elites everywhere, because I am not sure that Iran, Ahmadinejad, slogans of Khomeini, it's forever. In 20 years, in dozens of years, somebody will come, and what Russia will do. It means that indeed Russia has no strategic political line for the future. And I don't know people who is able to elaborate it. Is somebody from those who is coming in Egypt, while in Libya, somewhere else, in Yemen maybe, are they interested to improve relations with Russia? I think not, because they have choice. They have options between America, Europe, China, maybe, and somebody else. So I think that, well, excuse me to be so pessimist, but anyway, I think that Russia is a force, is a country, is a power who is disappearing. Of course, it will occupy a niche. Of course, it will occupy a certain place. But I think that its disappearance, it's a strategic a disappearance. It's forever. Its conclusion, and if I have 1 minute, a short appendix, because sometimes I'm asked about the impact of Arab spring and Islamic winter on Russian Muslimhood. Well, when it began, in February, in March, and so on, indeed, that was a democratic spring, and I am responsible for my words. Nobody was interested in Caucasus, inside Russian Muslim community. Nobody was interested in what is going in Egypt, while in Libya, and so on. Since the moment they saw how Islamic activity is rising, and what political parties and movements are coming, are moving to power, the interest, I jump up. And in Dagestan, and the biggest republic of North Caucasus, sometimes they began to say, if it's permitted to do such things in Cairo, in Libya, why not here? And as I know, the same ideas began to emerge in Uzbekistan, in Tajikistan, and even more. But I repeat, it's only appendix. If there are some questions, I attempt to answer. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Alexei. You know, listening to each of these presentations, I kind of distilled two basic points about Russia in the Middle East. One is that it's a loyal realist. It's a faithful realist, except it's an incompetent faithful realist, and so the results are as Alexei described them, and the strategy looks as bleak as it does. The second thing is that Russia's relationships, to the extent that the Kremlin's relationships with governments in the region can be described in relatively pure terms, it's the enemy of my enemy, that type of scenario. The problem appears to be, and this is true on both sides, that increasingly the enemy that matters more is the internal enemy. And so what I wonder, and maybe we're too early to have this conversation, certainly I would suggest we are on the Russian side, what happens when the relationship that matters is between a body politic and a body politic, and no longer between Vladimir Putin and Bashar Assad, or Ahmadinejad, or any of these others. But I'll just leave that out there, and I want to open the floor, because I'm sure we have questions. Just make sure, wait for the microphone, and give us your name and affiliation. And also, I can't see pretty much anything down the middle because of the Klieg light, so keep your hand really high up. Right here, and then we'll go here, and then I think I see a hand back there after.
This question is open, but I want to know, following in the Department of State and all the discussions that are going on in the United Nations where the U.S.
Name.
Sorry?
Name.
And my name is Andy Jude from Argentina, Perfil newspaper. I am seeing that there is a lot of pressure from the U.S. to Russia, especially in the United Nations, in order to make Russia urgently move towards a help when the human rights are really in danger. And I see that in the case of Venezuela, for example, where Russia has a lot of exchanges with the government of Chavez, I feel that the Russians feel much better there, and they show, and there is a much more public appearance, also more trips from Russia to Latin America, to these countries, because we don't see this kind of human rights violation that we are seeing in other countries. I think that, and this is the question, I want to know that if there is a limit in the Russia politics when they see that there is massive human rights problems and when there is really what we call diatribe. I think that the Russians go more for diatribe, but when we see this kind of human rights problems, the Russians try to turn and the situation gets in a different mood, right? This is my point of view.
So how cynical are they? And then let's take that second question and then we'll go to the panel. Anne, can you?
Imtiaz Bhatti, and I'm a doctoral student at the George Washington University. It was a very informative and wonderful discussion, but I was also expecting that panel would touch on Afghanistan also, because Afghanistan, I'm not sure I should place it in Central Asia or South Asia or Middle East, but Afghanistan occupies a pivotal position at the moment, and Russia's strategic interests are connected to it. What type of regime Russia would like to have in Afghanistan in near future vis-a-vis its strategic interests with America?
Okay, great. So we've got the question about human rights in the UN international context, and then what are Russia's interests in Afghanistan?
Human rights, it's not our topic.
Some it's very interesting, and I don't know how to respond. You know that human rights, it's a weak Russian problem. It's a problem which irritates and Putin and even Medvedev, by the way. So just I don't know even how to answer your question, because I think that after 4 March, something will change. And I think that the changes would be rather negative, because at the moment, while we have manifestation, some demonstration in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, of course, administration feels that it can encounter some problems. But after Putin will be elected, and some no doubt that it will be so, let's see. I'm afraid that the problem of human relations will deteriorate. I don't want to predict. Yeah, but anyway, in Russia, because I came from Russia 2 weeks ago, we discussed this problem and we fear. About Afghanistan, well, maybe you will disagree with me, but it seems that Afghanistan, it's not a key problem for Russia. Of course, They talk about it, but practically Russia did nothing for some peaceful solution. They say they promised, but they do nothing. And besides, the Afghan situation, the situation in that country, Islamic radicalism, Talibs, and so on, is a very good pretext for Moscow to tell to Central Asian countries, well, you live under the threat of Talibs, of Islamic extremists, so you have to be closer to Russia. From that point of view, I think that it's a very, maybe it sounds paradoxical, but the conflict inside Afghanistan gives Russian an opportunity to impact on Central Asia.
Yeah, I just would add, and then I think we'll go back to questions, that I think Russia would love any kind of government in Kabul that stops the drug trade. That's really Russia's main interest across the border. And that, by the way, historically was Taliban government, was effective at that, so that's fine. Okay, question here, and...
Yeah. My name is Alex Grigoriev, I'm working for Voice of America Russian Service. Can I ask you a reverse question? What we can say about Arabic and Iranian influence inside the Russia? How big, you know, this influence, and what about strategy of Arabic country and Iran toward Russia? Thank you.
Great, and let's take the second one right there.
Thank you. Mike Kraft, I'm a counterterrorism specialist, but in an earlier career, I served on the United Press International Middle East Desk in London during the 67 war. And I'm wondering if what we're seeing with Russia's involvement in the Middle East isn't really a throwback to the 60s. The Russians played a major role in precipitating the 67 war by putting out reports that the Israelis were massing on the border. They were sending large quantity of arms. And the interpretation of at least many of the British commentators at the time was that Russia had several goals: A, access to a port, Syrian ports, customers for its arms sales, and probably most important, as somebody alluded to, is sort of countering the American and to a lesser extent British influence. It seems to me these elements still exist, especially with Putin basically, you know, holding power for the last few years, with maybe the added dimension of the economics that you referred to. It's in Russian interest to keep the pot stirring, to keep oil prices high, and keep the Iranians out of the gas market. So just wondering what your view of that is.
Great. You know, Mike, just as an aside, and I mentioned this to Karim earlier, Ronan Bergman's long piece in the New York Times Magazine has just been pre-posted, and you're not the only one thinking that it looks like 1967. The problem is no one is addressing the Russian dimension of that, whether Russia is playing it the same way that they did, and I think you make an interesting case. So do you want to take that?
I'll take part of it, and then I think my colleagues there can continue. Well, about the interest, I think, of Russia in a conflict, let's say, with Iran. I think that Russia is, you know, its economy is based on the export of the oil, so they are interested to some point in low-grade conflict to keep the oil prices high enough, but they are not interested at all at regional war or things going out of control. Talking about the influence of, I think, the Arab countries and Iran inside Russia, I think Russia was... For many years, concerned of the influence of extreme Islam in its soft belly, you know, in Central Asia countries, and it treated very aggressively any attempts of foreign Wahhabis, you know, to come and preach in its mosque. It was, well, in Chechnya, in Dagestan and so on. You have tons of mosques. You can barely find, I think, serious now foreign influence, although the attempts, I think, were very widespread. And I think that, you know, of course, Russia's dealing with the Chechnya didn't add it to popularity in many neighborhoods in the Middle East. I think the point that we kind of missed in the discussion was, and it is something that we can add to this Russian pragmatism, pursuing its interests and so on. Russia also wants, to prove its standing against NATO and it's the nationalism in Russia makes sometimes statements and takes stands that are not pragmatic at all. Even with the Syria, you can say that arms sales are financial interests. But Syria does not always return its debt, so I'm not sure the financial it's such a smart decision. So it's more like to stay a player in the only place that still that is ready to cooperate.
Just a word on Russia's position vis-à-vis the conflict and whether it's different from the 60s. I think it's very different from the era of the 60s, in that it is amazing how quickly Russia dropped out of the picture after the end of the Cold War vis-à-vis the Arab-Israeli conflict. So for Russia, it was less, I think, an ideological position and more of a Cold War issue. When the Cold War ended, Russia's interest in the Arab-Israeli conflict seemed to have ended as well. After the Madrid Peace Conference, I mean, Russia's efforts regarding the conflict were minimal, if non-existing. Russia, in the few years ago, appointed, for example, a Middle East envoy to look at the Arab-Israeli conflict. That was really, mostly pro forma than anything else. Can anybody of you even name who that envoy is? I dealt with him personally, and I can't even name him. So, in all seriousness, I mean, it's for Russia. It seems, and for the people of the Middle East, this is becoming clear that Russia's position on the Arab-Israeli conflict stemmed mostly out of a Cold War confrontation than a genuine position. When you talk about the United States, at least you can tell what the interests of the United States are in the region vis-à-vis the Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel, oil, stability, etc. When it comes to Russia, if these are Russia's interests, they certainly did not pursue them after the end of
the post-peace conference in Moscow.
That was the end of it, which was in January 92, and that was the end of it. China, at least, does not claim to have a lot of political influence, but China shows its interest in the region with money. Russia does not show any interest with money, even if they have, even if they have it. So I just wanted to make that point.
I thought that Natasha captured well the Russian position on conflict with Iran, in that it's expedient for them to have this continued conflict. But they've been very outspoken in opposition to any type of military attack or a hot conflict, which I find interesting, because in some ways I would see it in Russia's interest if there were to be a military attack on Iran, for a few reasons. One, obviously oil prices skyrocket, which benefits Iran, benefits Russia economically. And by the way, China would be the big loser. Again, when we lump Russia and China together and their interests toward Iran, I think these countries actually have very different interests. China would be the huge loser in a military attack on Iran. In my opinion, Russia would benefit economically. It would likely, in my opinion, a military attack on Iran further entrench the Islamic Republic, alienate the Iranian public vis-a-vis the United States, and keep Iran in some ways under Russia's sphere of influence. So I personally see that they would actually benefit from a military attack on Iran. What I find interesting is that, we may kind of cynically dismiss what Russian officials say publicly about that topic, but even privately, when I looked at some of the WikiLeaks cables, even privately in their meeting with U.S. diplomats, they were very concerned about the prospect of a military attack on Iran. Let me just talk briefly about Iran's role in Russia. And I think it's too negligible to speak of Iran's role within Russia. What I think is more interesting is Iran's role in the former Soviet Union. And this is a source of criticism that many Iranians have of the Islamic Republic, and that the Islamic Republic has taken great pains and invested literally billions of dollars in courting Arabs in South Lebanon and in Palestine. And they have virtually neglected places like Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, especially Samarkand and Bukhara, which are famed cities in the Persian Empire. They've neglected these areas, which have historically been under Iran's sphere of influence, and places where oftentimes the folks are looking for some type of a greater Iranian role, especially in Tajikistan. So I think going to Matt's question about, you know, how might things change if you have a representative government in Iran, I would see that being one of the changes you would see in Iranian foreign policy, that less courting of the Palestinians and the Lebanese Shiites, and more focus on Iran's neighbors and, again, kind of cultural cousins in places like Tajikistan and Uzbekistan.
Great. Okay. Back there.
Yes, thanks. I'm Dave Pollack from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you very much for really interesting presentations. I want to focus back on the issue of Syria and Russian policy there right now. I guess this question is directed toward Mr. Malashenko, the Russian speaker. Do you think that the Russian leadership today agrees with you that Assad's regime is doomed, or do they still think, maybe wrongly, in your personal opinion, but do they still think that he can be saved somehow? And if they do agree with you privately, let's say deep down in their hearts, would they be willing, do you think, to make some kind of a deal for a transition that would remove Assad from power somehow and still try to preserve Russian influence in the country? Thank you.
Okay, and take another one here.
My name is Jafar Jafri with Al Mayadeen Television. I'm having trouble actually reconciling the general theme that's coming from the panelist, that Russia's influence in the Middle East is eroding, and some even termed it failure. And I take a look at that with Russia's exercise of the veto power at the UN, which was unprecedented for the Soviet Union at the time. And this is really the first time ever that a member of the Security Council has exercised the veto power on behalf of an Arab cause. Not only that, but also China as well. China has never had an open policy regarding the Arab world. Now, having said that, the premise that some of the panelists were talking about, that Russia has historical baggage as well as resentment among the Arab population, and that may be true, and that's true with every superpower worldwide throughout history. But on the other hand, isn't this position that Russia has exercised at the UN supporting its renewed influence in the region?
Okay. Alexei, I guess, will you take the first one?
Just the question about Assad and so on. Well, I think, it's in my private opinion, that in Moscow are tired of Bashar, because indeed they did their best. And sometimes there is an opinion that indeed he's a little bit abnormal, because, well, practically everything was done. But even now, just I forgot, maybe it was last week, once again Moscow proposed to come to Russian capital and to talk once again. But just it's unbelievably difficult to imagine how it could go, such kind of negotiations. So I think that there is an opinion that the pressure, the possibility to impact on Bashar is a little bit exhausted. Yeah. I think if somebody doesn't kill him, I mean Damascus, finally he will come to Moscow. How it will happen, I don't know. So maybe it will be a top mystery. But I think that at the moment it's only one place where he can continue to work as a dentist. Oh, no. Ophthalmologist. I'm sorry. Yes. By the way, like Askar Akayev, who came to Moscow and who now works at Moscow University. I'm not sure that I'm right, but I think that this history with 36 aircrafts, it is destined for the future and not for Assad. It's a very interesting tactic, because these aircrafts could arrive to Syria only since 2013, and everybody is sure that in 2013 it will not be Assad.
Can I just inject? I think you may be giving the Russian leadership too much credit for thinking objectively right now. I think they're under a lot of psychological pressure not to think about regime change, period, and quite seriously. I don't know that they're drawing a direct analogy, but it's not a comfortable line of thought if you're sitting in the Kremlin right now. Marwan?
I think the notion that because Russia can cast a veto in the Security Council is a suggestion that its influence is not eroding in the Middle East I disagree with that notion completely. First of all, the Russian veto in the UN is not in disagreement today with the Western world. It is in disagreement with the majority view of the Arab League itself. That is, the region does not agree with Russia. And this is a situation where, you know, you can't be more Catholic than the Pope, basically. The Syrian public itself, most of the publics of the region, are in disagreement with this view. And if you look at the countries who have been sort of the minority view in the Arab League regarding Syria, it is Lebanon, for obvious reasons. It is Iraq. And it is Algeria. These are the countries that are all the other countries of the Arab League disagree with the Syrian position today. Russia is not going to be able to maintain its position in the Security Council indefinitely. There will come a time when the killings in the country will demand that something happens, and the excuses that Russia gives today for why it is standing in the Security Council cannot hold forever when you killed, you know, 40, 50 people every single day as it is happening today. Today, I mean, as we speak, there is a new Security Council resolution in the making. And maybe Russia will veto that one too, but there will be another one and another one. And I think at some point in time, Russia is not going to be able to withstand the tide that is coming its way. Syria is the last Arab country that is an ally of Russia. And when Syria falls, Russia is going to be left with no friends in the Arab world. And I think I would agree with Alexei that in my own view, we are witnessing a strategic disappearance, as you call it, forever, of Russian influence in the region.
Okay. We had a couple over here. Yeah, right here.
My name is Nick Wondra. I'm a student at SAIS. First, I'd like to challenge Karim to defend your logic how any military action or war in Iran could possibly benefit Russia besides an oil price. I don't see any military action on an immediate border of any great power being beneficial to that great power. And second, I would like anyone on the panel to elaborate how Russian policymakers perceive regime change versus the integrity of a state. Right now, it seems to me that the regime in Syria is a direct parallel of territorial integrity, which is something that concerns the Russian establishment very much, particularly regarding NATO and missions in many places around the world. Is this a concern as you see it, and is there space for Russian policy to change from this being one and the same to being a separation between the regime in Syria and the state of Syria?
Okay, and there was another right here.
Kathy Kosman, this is a question to Alexei. You mentioned that you would be willing to elaborate a little bit further about the possible effect of Muslim Brotherhood, et cetera, in certain governments or societies in Central Asia. And also, I was wondering whether anyone could address an important but tangential player in all of this, and that's Turkey, how Russia interacts with Turkey.
Whoa. Okay, so we have a lot of questions here. So, Karim, maybe you can start with us just on the benefit, if any, of, I think what you said was benefit of cold confrontation.
No,
right?
No, I said that that's what, Natasha said that, that's what Russian officials publicly articulate. I agreed with her that that's what Russian officials publicly articulate. And I went further to say that I see it could be expedient for Russia to have U.S. military attack on Iran. We're not talking about an Iraq-style regime change where you have 130,000 troops. We're talking about limited military strikes on Iran's nuclear installations. In addition to the risk premium of oil prices skyrocketing, which is useful for Russia. As I mentioned with that quote from the Foreign Minister Salehi, the concerns, the Russian concerns, which the Iranians very much play upon, that Iran falls back under the sphere of influence of the West. In my opinion, a military attack on Iran, a U.S. military attack on Iran, further entrenches the Islamic Republic, and it further entrenches Iran under the sphere of influence of Russia, and it alienates the Iranian body politic. It soils the oasis of goodwill in Iran on a popular level, which exists vis-a-vis the United States. So for those reasons, I see a limited military strike on Iran, a limited U.S. military strike on Iran as a net benefit for Russia. And by the way, no one has ever said that of all the various scenarios you look at in terms of how Iran would retaliate, and I've taken part in many of these crisis simulations, Iran lobbing missiles into the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, Iran unleashing Hezbollah, Hamas, none of the scenarios call for Iran to do anything in Chechnya or in places of Russia's sphere of influence. So again, I see the cost for Russia somewhat negligible and the benefits, what I just mentioned.
Yeah, and I think I can dispense with your question about this divergence between regime stability and intervention, and that's exactly the point. I think Russia draws a red line at what NATO did in Libya. But the Syrian regime, as Alexei suggests, can be brittle and can fall apart entirely without NATO intervention on a concrete, military level. And the second, I want to turn to Alexei in the second basket of questions about Muslim Brotherhood in Central Asia, but I also have to add a question.
About Turkey, yes?
And Turkey, yeah.
About Turkey.
And I want to get Natasha in as well. But Alexei, can I add a question for you to consider too? Maybe Marwan as well. Does it matter that Muslim Brotherhood aligned parties are also now, that essentially their attention is being more widely spread to also legitimate opportunities to win power, that they don't have to do it. In Central Asia, clearly, it would have to be under the table, but now they have opportunities sort of all over the place. So does it matter in terms of their willingness to go in that direction?
I don't know. I don't know indeed, because nobody knows. But let's imagine the situation where, semi-official penetration of Muslim Brothers took place in Caucasus. What kind of reaction we'll have? I think that will be a typical double reaction. And in any case, some members, I would say, of Russian political establishment began to not to renew, but maybe construct their relations with Muslim brothers. Don't forget that in Russian Duma, in Russian parliament, there is a special Islamic committee who deals with them unofficially. So let's see. But it will go. And about Turkey, yes, if it's possible. Catherine, it's a very interesting question. Sometimes they say in Russian Federation that we observe now a second or reemergence of Turkish influence, but under Turkic slogans, like it was in 90s. Now maybe they will be more successful, because in 90s it was a decline in Russia and in Central Asia. But they say that they bring with them a moderate Islam. But I wonder, this is a moderate Islam which comes from a Turkish moderate Islamism who support a Muslim brothers in Egypt. Yes?
Let me start with Turkey. I think it's once again quite ironic that Israel, for example, finds itself wary of Turkey along with Russia, but for diametrically opposite reasons, because Israel's relationship between Ankara and Jerusalem deteriorated on the basis of its being too pro-Islamic and supporting flotilla and so on. And in Russia, it's quite the opposite, because they don't like Turkey now because of their pro-Western orientation, their membership in NATO, their acceptance of the anti-missile shield, and so on. So, and they don't like Turkish intervention in Syria. I think the point is that Russia doesn't like now any idea of interventions anyway. Interventions, sanctions, anything that can be emulated or at some point maybe even applied to Russia itself. So I think that both of you mentioned it before, that dealing with, preoccupied now very much with the domestic problems, Russia actually sees in all those interventions a ghost of possible demise of its own regime. I would say that it doesn't look like anything like 1917. It's more like maybe 1905 protests, but still it's not pleasant for the current regime. And the last thing, I think, why do the Russian regime sticks with Syria now, although there is no apparent reason to do it? I think it's just inertia for some part, because unlike cooperation with Iran, with Syria, it was historic Soviet cooperation, and they don't really want to look bad. It will be a serious embarrassment, especially after the American president called on Bashar Assad to step down. What, like the Russian president will do it? It's unthinkable. So.
Too bad they didn't go first, right?
I want to say a word about the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, I'll make a prediction here, which is that I don't think foreign policy under the Muslim Brotherhood in any Arab country where they will have a major influence is going to change much. And this might come as a surprise to some of you, but we are dealing, I think, with a Muslim Brotherhood that is pragmatic, that will follow positions that are less ideological and more pragmatic. They understand that they have severe economic challenges facing their countries. It is absolutely the wrong policy to isolate yourself and not deal with the outside world. And I maintain that even applies to the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, that you might not find many, if any, Egyptian officials meeting with Israeli officials in the near future. Frankly, Israeli officials are having a hard time meeting with any Arabs these days, not Muslim Brotherhood or otherwise. So I don't think that Russia is going to find a hard time dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood if it wants to. But it's not. I don't think that there will be a resistance on part of Muslim Brotherhood-led governments in the Middle East to deal with Russia or anybody else, for that matter.
A very short remark concerning Muslim Brother. Muslim Brother was the first organization who penetrated from abroad to North Caucasus. It was 1989 in the Soviet times, and that was a branch of or from Syria or maybe from Jordan.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. There is one. No? Anything final from the panel? No? Okay. All right, thank you all.
Thank you.